from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. A scientist in China announced this week that he had created the world's first genetically edited human baby. In an announcement that shocked many, including scientists and ethicists, He Zhengkui said he altered a gene in the embryos of twin girls to make them resistant to HIV. Forum talks about the future and ethics of using new gene editing tools like CRISPR to create genetically altered humans. And that's next, after this. Welcome to this morning's forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Since the invention of CRISPR and other new gene editing tools, there has been concern that one day they would be used to genetically modify embryos, creating so-called designer babies. That day may now be here. A scientist in China, He Zhengkui, has claimed to have edited the embryos of twin girls born last month to be resistant to HIV. And at an international human genome editing summit going on in Hong Kong now, the scientist announced that another CRISPR pregnancy is now underway. Joining us in studio to discuss the developments and the ethics of gene editing of embryos is Fyodor Ernov. He's visiting researcher at the Innovative Genomics Institute, University of California, Berkeley, formerly vice president at Sangamo, that's the first company to actually edit human genes, and welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Glad to have you. Also glad to have Alex Marson, who's also here with us in studio, infectious disease doctor, gene editing expert. He heads the Marson Lab at UCSF and is the scientific director of biomedicine at the Innovative Genomics Institute. Welcome.
Great to be here.
Good to have you. Also good to have Marcy Darnovsky, who is executive director of the Center for Genetics and Society. They're a nonprofit, and they work for responsible uses of new human genetic technology. Welcome, Marcy.
Thanks, Michael.
Good to have you. Good to have you all here. And let's begin with you, Fyodor Ernov. And Dr. Ernov, I'm struck by the fact that we may not know this whole story yet. A lot of it is murky, and we'll try to unpack it as best we can. But there's a good deal of course, discussion, to put it mildly, about the ethics, and we'll get into that as well. But critics say this experiment is premature. We don't have evidence and we don't have data.
We don't. Zhengkui He presented a lot more data last night in Hong Kong than any of us have ever seen. And I sat there in front of my screen with bated breath, hopeful that he would frankly retract his claims, that he would say, oh, I beg your pardon, I didn't really do this. Purely as a gene editor, so leaving the ethics and the clinical issues to my esteemed colleagues here, as a gene editor, I can say that the science checks out. It does appear, in fact, that he took human embryos from obtained by fertilization from a man who is HIV positive and a woman who is HIV negative.
And excuse me, that's something that wasn't even necessary. It could be done in other ways, right?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
He injected them, that embryo, with CRISPR, the technical term for which is Cas9. And the great thing about CRISPR is you can program it, as was discovered by our colleague Jennifer Doudna and Emmanuel Charpentier, you can program it to cut any gene. He programmed that CRISPR to cut a gene, the removal of which, in principle, could make a human being resistant to infection by the most common form of HIV. He then, as we heard last night, implanted those embryos into a number of women. And in the case of one person, the embryos took, that's a term from the IVF field, and twin girls were born, one of whom is, in fact, a fully gene-edited human being, assuming that the data he showed last night are true, in the sense that she, in fact, lacks two normal copies of that gene. The other, her twin, is genetically different from her, and that's the slightly stochastic nature of the gene editing process. The other twin is, in fact, genetically not completely edited. So even though they're twins, they were born to the same mom from the same dad, they are now genetically unequal.
You heard him talk a few months ago at Cold Spring Harbor, and you thought when you found out this news, you said you were hoping that the news would be curtailed by some sense of perhaps not being true or whatever. But at the time you thought, or in retrospect, he was a pretty good poker player. He didn't really show many cards at that, did he?
I would never play any game against Dr. He. He presented much of the data he showed yesterday in 2017. at Cold Spring Harbor, which is an elite meeting of gene editors. And all of us were in the room looking at his results. And frankly, it was ho-hum. People have been gene editing embryos for 10 years. So there's, you know, there he is gene editing a mouse embryo and then a monkey embryo and then taking discarded human embryos from IVF clinics, editing them as well. Not a syllable was uttered about the fact that he in fact has a quote-unquote clinical trial and that in fact there will be women carrying gene-edited fetuses that ultimately will produce twin girls. I am astonished at the fact that he presented the data he did the way he did without telling all of us what he was up to. But I guess we were all unfortunate witnesses to that having been done.
And Marcy Darnovsky, we did a program a couple of years ago with UC Berkeley about CRISPR, and at the time you were sending out some serious alarms. I mean, this is kind of a worst-case scenario in many ways in terms of being in this brave new world.
Well, yes and no. It is really incredibly dismaying and disturbing that this has happened. And it really, I do think it is the kind of scenario that we had in mind, a scenario in which someone who stands to benefit, a researcher who stands to get fame, maybe fortune.
There's a video, kind of thing, there's promotional material.
Which he arranged beforehand, yeah. So he did it in a kind of a grandstanding way. And I think in future, if this were to be done on a broader scale, which is the real problem, you would have people get doing it for money. And, you know, this is a particular trait that's been altered. That's very hard to say whether it's therapeutic or enhancement.
Could be eliminating genetic diseases, though, right?
Well, we don't need to do germline editing to eliminate the transmission of genetic diseases. We have other ways of doing that. And that's a key point that's often lost in these conversations.
So the road possibly to eugenics and all kind of designer babies is really what we're talking about.
That is, I think, what's at stake here. And we have to name it.
Let me ask you about a comment that came from Hank Greeley, who our listeners know, Stanford leading bioethicist. He said is unequivocally to be condemned. He called it criminally reckless and certainly didn't mince his words here. He said this could actually lead to sick babies, disabled babies, and dead babies.
That's a risk. There are the immediate risks of harm to children whose genes have been modified when they were at an embryo stage. Some of those for things that we can see if our tools get better, but some for things that we're not going to be able to predict. And I think my colleagues here will be able to speak to that better than I can. But there are also these larger social risks. And if we don't look at this application of a very powerful technology in the context of our history and our current situation of resurgent racism and xenophobia and increasing socioeconomic disparities, and think about what the social consequences could be of a world of genetic haves and have-nots, then I think we're not thinking about this in a serious way.
Marcy Darnovsky, again, excuse me, is executive director of the Center for Genetics and Society, and they're a nonprofit that works for responsible uses of new human genetic technologies. And Alex Marson is also here. He's an infectious disease doctor and gene editing expert. I think the first reaction you had was scary.
I guess that's what I've been quoted as. And indeed it is. I think that there's really on three levels of concern that are raised by this news. First is what I can consider a technological concern. We don't know that this was done safely and effectively. This does not clear the bar for the risk benefit that was offered to these children. We don't know whether the edits are going to be effective at preventing HIV, in particular as the data emerges, and there's a risk of off-target, unexpected consequences of editing other parts of the genome. And there are serious health risks associated with these that I don't think have been cleared to the level that it would be necessary for a clinical trial for involving babies. The second is a concern, what I consider a biological concern. Even if we had a perfect edit, we're taking on a level of risk about the unknown unknowns, about the unintended consequences. Even if we edit a gene that we think we know about, we have to have a certain amount of humility in the face of that there could be unintended consequences for any genetic modification. To be very specific, in this case, the attempt was to edit a gene to confer resistance to HIV. There is also literature that the lack of this gene confers risk of worse outcomes with West Nile virus. That is one specific concern, but it's indicative of a larger concern that any genetic modification in a different context could have negative and unintended consequences, and we have to be humble about that. And then the third, as you heard from my colleagues, is an ethical concern, and this is critical. When we as we move in, I think this is really a categorical change in how we think about our offspring. This is not an extension of IVF, as was suggested by the doctor who did these trials. This is actually a categorical leap into the ability to manipulate the genetic material that encodes our offspring. And I think that we have to pause and really consider what that means for our humanity if we take that into our hands and aspire to a level of control over heredity that we've never seen before in our history.
So you're saying is echoed by David Baltimore, famous scientist who's chairing a summit that's going on in Hong Kong now, where Jennifer Doudna is, that it could affect the whole gene pool.
I think that that is a serious risk. You heard about the risk of haves and have-nots. I think that there's also a risk that we start losing diversity, that we have a groupthink about what becomes desirable and lose the something that makes us fundamentally human, the chance, the variety. And as we take more and more control over our offspring, I think that we face a hubris about thinking that we can design better than nature. And I think that that will affect our gene pool if we're not cautious about it. I think we're hearing an outcry of reaction against this, and I think that that's appropriate, and I hope that that stems this tide. But I am concerned.
I think there may be a difference, and let me go to this right away, between you and Dr. Ernov in terms of the ethics of doing this eventually. I think, Dr. Ernov, it's safe to say that you can look down the road here and think, there's lots of positive things here that can't come to pass, and we should move them.
That, I think, Michael, is – I'd like to first of all, I agree with everything my colleagues just said. I'd like to add a fourth concern, which is the following. We've learned a lot about the genetics of human disease in the past 100 years, since the first studies showed that actually human differences are due to genes. And a major advance of the past 30 years has been the ability to take adults or children with genetic disease and manipulate their DNA in the aim to either eliminate the disease or to at least ameliorate it. And Dr. Marson has done important work of this type on autoimmunity in his lab at UCSF. And at Sangamo, my colleagues and I did quite a bit of such work for example, HIV. One of the really exciting findings of human genetics is the discovery of genes, the loss of which protects us against disease. And pharma companies have paid close attention to this. So, for example, here comes a scientific acronym that I think the listeners would be interested in, PCSK9. That sounds like a mouthful, but here's a fact. If you don't have a normal copy of that gene, your risk of heart disease is lower by 90%. So those rare human beings who appear to have won a genetic lottery, who don't have a normal copy of that gene, are really protected from heart attack. So pharma companies have made medicines that basically disable the product of this gene. I think it costs about $20,000 a year maybe to take that medicine. And you have to take it for life, of course. But there you have it. I'm very curious what Marcy and Alex think about this. Do I see a future 50 years from now where after an extended series of rigorous safety and efficacy studies in animals with extensive consultation with physicians, regulators, scientists, we start considering the selective elimination of PCSK9 from the children of parents who are at higher risk for heart disease because of diet or other factors? I think this is something we should discuss. But what I also think is what Jianque headed puts us directly away from that path, because he did this outside of the context of existing ethical, regulatory, or frankly, clinical oversight.
Well, there's a lot in what you have proposed here in terms of the conditions under which this could move forward. Some thoughts from you, Dr. Marson, on this?
I think that Dr. Ernov is absolutely right to bring up the issue of PCSK9. I think that this is on all of our minds, and I think it also highlights an area where there's going to be a blur between medical need and enhancement. Is if you're 90% protected from a heart attack, is that an enhancement or is that a medical need? And, you know, to my mind, I think this is something we have to think seriously about. But I think it also forces us to think where each of us and as a community, where we're going to draw the line in the sand. For me, and I'll say this is a personal view that I feel strongly about, I think embryo editing and so-called germline editing, where the DNA edits will be passed on to future generations, is where I draw the line in the sand. It's not saying that gene editing can't be used in ways that I think will have enormous consequences for human health, but I think right at this point, the line that I don't want to cross is editing that will be passed on to future generations.
So where are you, Marcy Darnowski, on this?
Well, that's very much where I am, but it is some people's, including ours, a personal view. It is also the law in about 40 countries around the world. And in fact, in every country where the conversation got to the point that a legislature was discussing it, every one of those cases, a law was passed that draws that line between using these really wonderful, powerful gene modification tools to help people who are sick. That's what we want to do. And we want to make sure it's safe, it's effective, it's affordable. But what we want to keep off limits, at least for the foreseeable future, unless there's some huge change that I don't foresee, we want to keep off limits germline modification, meaning altering the genes of early stage embryos such that that child that results and all that child's offspring would reflect in every cell of their bodies changes that somebody made in a laboratory.
Maybe time for me to ask you, our listeners, to weigh in here. In fact, if you have questions or comments, now would be a good time for you to call, and we invite you to do that. Our toll-free number is available. The number to call, 866-733-6786. Again, you can join us live at 866-733-6786. You can also join us by emailing us, forum@kqed.org, or going right to our website, kqed.org/forum. Click on this segment or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum, and let's talk a little bit about Alzheimer's here, Dr. Ernov, with you. I mean, say maybe 50 years, would it be safe with testing? You said 10 years, but give it a half century, perhaps.
Well, here's another example of the fact that we haven't, I think, yet had the chance to deeply think about this as a species. I fully share Dr. Marston's take that the boundary between enhancement and clinical use is in fact a blurry one. It really is. Alzheimer's, 6 million people in America have it. It's a disease we can't currently prevent. We cannot treat or slow down. Now, there is a variant of a gene. Again, here comes another mouthful, but I suspect many of the listeners will have heard of it. There's a variant of a gene called APOE4. And if you are unlucky to have landed yourself two copies of that thing, you are about 80% likely to get Alzheimer's disease. And if you do get it, you will get it in your 60s, whereas most folks who do get Alzheimer's get it in their 80s and 90s. So now, here's something that we as a species haven't yet figured out how to do, what to do about. Imagine a couple, both of them have this APOE4. So the only kind of child that they could have, they know is at a much greater risk for Alzheimer's. Although, of course, that will not play itself for 60 years, by which point in time one presumes neither of the two parents will be on planet Earth. What do you do? Now imagine an offshore clinic. This is rapidly blurring the boundaries between science fiction and science reality, but I guess in the wake of what Junkwei He showed us, I don't even know where that boundary is anymore. Imagine on a website, cutalzheimersoutofyourdna.com, and you sign up for, based on the fact that gene therapy cures are priced at $1 million, I would imagine that they would charge, $5-20 million. I don't know, but there would be a sizable number. And you go to that offshore clinic, such as the stem cell offshore clinics that Marcy, I'm sure, can tell us volumes of horror stories about. And on that offshore clinic, you get an embryo edited, APOE4 is rid of in a presumably safe way, and there you go. You've at least eliminated that concern from your germline. Michael, if you had run this by me 10 years ago when at Sangamo we were doing our first gene editing trials, I would have thought this is unimaginable. And here we are. And I'm curious what Dr. Marcin and Marcy think about this. But I mean, what Jiankui has showed us is that we have to start having deeper conversations about these things than we've had so far, I guess.
And also having to pay more attention to things that you mentioned, like the security and really watching, monitoring, and being safe about all this. Marcy, you want to weigh in here?
Right. So, you know, this is so technically complicated, but it's also so complicated from a social and policy point of view. And I think one thing to say, and I think some of the suggestions that Alex and Fyodor have made go to this point, we have to worry about people like Jiankui He and what he did sort of outside the boundaries. But we also have to worry about the way that the mainstream scientists and bioethicists, I'm afraid, may have facilitated this by not making it clear that we have to draw a bright line now, at least until we have this figured out. So we can't be issuing reports, as has been done over the last couple of years, that don't make it crystal clear that it's not a green light for germline modification. And several high-level reports have come out and said, oh, yeah, we'll do it under these conditions. But they haven't been clear enough that it's not okay now and that it's likely to lead to the kind of really dire social consequences that we're starting to talk about here. And I think this is a wake-up call for mainstream scientists and bioethicists to be a lot more careful and think a lot more deeply about the kinds of reports and recommendations that they're putting out.
Well, he said he got permission from the clinic, but they have put out a statement saying otherwise and actually saying that this was shocking to them.
And he said that the National Academy's report in 2017 gave him a green light.
Yeah, well, the National Academy did say, I think I have this right, that it's okay down the line, but just what Dr. Ernoff said, it has to be done under the right conditions and has to make sure that it's being done with all the safeguards. You going to add something, Dr. Marcin?
Yeah, I guess I would like to add at this point a little bit of a note of optimism about the power of gene editing at the same time. I think that as we talk about the risks here, I think that we should also recognize that this is a technology that's incredibly powerful, that is catching the imagination of scientists and the popular press alike.
It has extraordinary potential.
Exactly. And, I mean, with that power comes the risk. And I think that from my point of view, my goal is not to put my head in the sand and say this technology does not exist. It's a matter of focusing the efforts on the areas where I think we're in the ethical clear, where we can have immediate and powerful consequences for understanding how our genome controls our health and for editing cells in ways that could potentially cure a wide range of human disease. This is so-called cell therapy. The idea, and this is something that my lab is focused on heavily, many others, places where we can target gene editing to particular cells, change just the function of those cells, and then use those cells as a drug, where that won't be passed, the genetic change won't be passed on to future generations. We're making living drugs with genetic modifications to cure human diseases.
Talking about the announcement by a Chinese scientist that he had created the world's first genetically edited human baby. And we will continue. We'll hear your calls when we return. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking about the announcement by a Chinese scientist that he had created the world's first genetically edited human baby, and if that is indeed true, it brings us to a crossroads that we haven't seen since Louise Brown, the first baby that was created through IVF. And the ethics of this, of course, has gotten us into a very serious debate about the future of CRISPR, which ties in with this, I should say. In fact, there's a summit that we've alluded to a couple times going on now in Hong Kong that's an international summit trying to deal with these kinds of questions, and indeed we're trying to deal with them here on the air. We have three experts with us in studio, Marcy Darnofsky, who is Executive Director of the Center for Genetics and Society, and Alex Marcin, who is infectious disease doctor and gene editing expert and heads the Marcin Lab over at UCSF, and Fyodor Ernov, who is a visiting researcher at the Innovative Genomics Institute, the University of California, Berkeley. Let me go right to your calls, and let's begin with Martin. Good morning. You're on the air.
Hey, thank you. This is a great topic. The way I see this, we're in the early stages. Certainly, it will exponentially, move forward. And I see what's going to happen is we're either going to at least approach or exceed the Hayflick limit, which would mean that, you know, people would live as long as they're designed to live and possibly longer, and that would mean have disastrous social consequences in terms of food and space, you know, and resources. And so I don't know where this can go other than causing, you know, the human species to live a quality life, but a very struggled life in the future. Anyway, it seems...
That's an important cautionary note. You take this under advisement, Marcy, in the work you do? I mean, population increases and all, the longevity increases and so forth with CRISPR?
You know, we're a lot more focused on the potential for these kinds of technologies to exacerbate the obscene levels of inequality and discrimination that we already live with, and really trying to put a bottle on those. We don't want to be going down a road where some people are, you know, born who are thought to be superior to everybody else, whether it's an individual or a group, an identifiable group in society. That's what we see as the clear and present danger.
Let me thank the caller and go right to another caller, and that's a caller from Castro Valley. Ram, you're on. Good morning.
Hi, Michael. Thanks for taking my call. So my comment is I want to continue the research because it has tremendous bright potential. Just think about it. Human body, what it is, basically a biological robot, and that is driven by things like computer software called genetic code. And if you're able to change the genetic code to do the good things, then you can make a superhuman completely disease-free. This research should continue, and we want to be superhuman.
Well, Nietzsche predicted perhaps that we would go along this road. I mean, we can't, Alex Marsden, be talking about superhuman beings here with CRISPR, really.
I think that in some ways that's the risk that we're talking about. You know,
that's what made you say scary.
I'm heavily influenced in my thinking on this by a book that I read over a decade ago by Michael Sandel, The Case Against Perfection. In many ways, the risk that we're talking about here is the risk of an excessive mastery of what we consider to be human. And I think that for each of us, the line may be different. I don't accept that we should put our head in the sand and not treat diseases out of a passive acceptance, nor does Sandel. But for me, as we think about what happened this week, we're entering into a new era where we are within reach of really exactly what the caller talked about, thinking that we can redesign what it means to be human with a goal of becoming superhuman. And to me, that raises extraordinary concerns about how we'll think about ourselves as a species, how we think about the gift of being human and the gift of our genetic material.
We have enough to be concerned about with artificial intelligence, but let me go to you, Fyodor Arnaud.
I share Alex's concern, but Ram, to your point about superhumans, one doesn't have to edit the embryo to enhance who you are. Let's take the exact case of HIV, which is Dr. Marson's medical specialty and my scientific one. Clinical trials, in fact, are underway to take adults with HIV, rid them of CCR5, and in a number of the subjects, these individuals no longer have to take antiretroviral medication because they have acquired, quote, the superhuman, unquote, ability to control HIV and resist it. Do I see a future where we have a CRISPR-based genetic vaccine against HIV in individuals who live in high-risk populations, a vaccine that you get, let's say, at age 12, around the same time that you get some other vaccine like Gardasil against HPV? Absolutely. The key difference, Ram, between what I just described and embryo editing is precisely the line in the sand that Dr. Marson alluded to, which is, do we change the DNA of future generations? That's the key difference. So I am all for, you know, genetic enhancements to consenting adults. You know, people inject Botox into their faces to get rid of wrinkles. You know, in a society that accepts that, surely a little bit of CRISPR here and there to change some aspect of you with consent, and if it's safe and effective, would not be all that bad. But I am with both Marcy and Alex as far as thinking very hard about the germline business.
Well, here's a comment that goes right to your point in many ways. Robert writes, please have your guests assume for the moment that the presence of a single specific gene was necessary to develop a terrible disease such as ALS or cystic fibrosis. If this gene could be eliminated in an embryo and thus save the life of the carrier, do they still maintain that the procedure should not be done? What kind of ethics would that be?
Well, here's the answer to that. We can already make sure that people at risk of passing on those kinds of diseases don't do so, that anyone who is a carrier can have a child who is unaffected and who is genetically related to both members of a heterosexual couple. And that can be done with an existing embryo screening technique called pre-implantation genetic diagnosis that's been available in fertility clinics for a quarter of a century. And that, you know, raises its own ethical questions, to be sure, but not at the level and not in the most socially fraught way that germline editing, heritable genetic engineering would do.
Another comment from a listener, actually a question. Joseph writes, let me go to you, Dr. Marson. IVF is now at another level as you quibble about therapy versus enhancement. So it is okay to use technology to cure a diseased human, but not okay to use technology to prevent disease? Opposition of vaccination technology presented similar arguments in its infancy. The real question is, who is the decider? And I think in this case, Hsiung Kuei said this is like a vaccine. I mean, he made that analogy.
So let me back up and say there are ways in which medicine has moved us beyond the natural, and I think that rightly so. In the case of HIV, we have remarkable success both at treating patients and at dramatically reducing the risk of transmission with existing antiretrovirals. So my goal is not to argue that we shouldn't intervene on disease. It's a question of where and how we should without changing heredity. Let me give you a very specific example of how we are using gene editing exactly to respond to pressing medical need for a rare genetic disease. There's a family that has been seeing doctors around the country that has multiple children affected by mutations that cause severe form of autoimmune disease, type 1 diabetes. Another child has an autoimmune attack on cells in the blood that's causing an ongoing need for immunosuppression. We and others, our collaborators, have tracked this down to a specific mutation in a critical gene for the immune system. We know that this gene is critical for cells in the immune system, and we're targeting our effort to actually correct cells from these children outside of the body. So we get blood samples from the children carrying these mutations. We purify the cells that we know are affected. We actually make a targeted gene correction in these cells. And we're systematically now going through and confirming that the modifications we're making are precise and effective. We're going to go through a rigorous safety process. When we're convinced that this is going to be safe and effective, then we're going to go through a stepwise regulatory process of applying to do a clinical trial and do this systematically. I think this is an opportunity to then give these gene-corrected cells back to the children with the idea of treating the underlying genetic disease in the cells that are affected by the genetic mutation. So we're not ignoring the possibility of gene editing to cure disease. We're just saying let's think about where we deploy this to maximize the effect without affecting the future genetic material of our species.
No, kudos for being so thorough on this. Let me get another caller aboard here, and let me go next to Luna. Luna, join us.
Hi, Michael. Love the show.
Thank you.
You guys talked earlier about the haves and the have-nots, and to me it seems like germline editing is for everybody instead of, you know, cell gene therapy. What's the cost of that when it's generation after generation having to take pills for their lifetime? That's for the haves. And furthermore, if you look at something like abortion, when abortion was illegal before, the haves could get it and the have-nots could not.
Marcy Darnowski?
So I think you're saying, do we have it upside down? And I don't think we do. I think that if we were to deploy gene editing in fertility clinics, we know that this would be expensive procedures. We know that fertility clinics, especially in this country, are very scantily regulated. It's a lucrative business. It is expensive. People who are able to access it are from the already affluent privileged classes by and large. And I think you would see marketing from these fertility clinics about how you must act now. This is just really a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity, but you have to do it before you get pregnant. You can see the ad copy kind of writes itself.
Do it for your future children. Do it for your progeny. Do it.
That's right. That's right. So I think we would be really setting ourselves up for not the just the, you know, billionaires, but for people who, you know, spend $30,000, $50,000 a year to send their kids to private school, people in that strata, to make use of this, and then that their children, whether or not the actual genetic modification made any biological difference, would be perceived as being superior, treated as being superior. You know, we know that if you put a bunch of kids in a classroom, and you tell the teacher with the IQ of the different kids, the teacher treats the children differently. And I think that would then take hold. And these are the kind of social dynamics, commercial dynamics, that I think we really need to think through and understand that those things and those predictions are every bit as complicated and every bit as in need of careful consideration as the details of the actual genetic modification tools and finding out what the off-target effects are and so on.
Yeah, it kind of undermines this American idealism and utopia about egalitarianism. Dr. Orlov?
On the topic of have and have-nots, and if I may touch on a theme which I think the two previous callers have raised, which is an important one, is it in fact the case that CRISPR represents a way to rid humanity of genes we don't want by editing the embryos, and that scientists and physicians are just being too cautious? And I really want to echo what Dr. Marston said. The first rule of medicine is do no harm. Gene editing is an experimental procedure. It has known risks and unknown risks. The worst thing that could happen is for something dire to occur, which will then set this field back by decades. I am frankly holding my breath that the two girls in China grow up healthy, because if heaven forbid something is not right, I cannot imagine what that would do to the critical effort that Dr. Marston described and Marcy referred to on repairing genetic defects in adults and children. But there's one other thing I want to say. We learned last night from Zhenkui He that the edited twins are not equal. They were born to the same parents. They were carried in the same womb. But one of them lacks CCR5 and so is actually, assuming things check out, presumably resistant to HIV. The other one is still genetically normal. The mother of gene editing, a scientist at Memorial Sloan Kettering named Maria Jason, asked Zhenkui He last night, "Dr. He, you realize, of course, you've just made two unequal human beings. In a country with high prevalence of HIV, the edited one is more attractive breeding material than the other one who is normal. Have you thought about what you've done here?" He didn't answer the question.
As long as we're also talking about equality and all that, here's a tweet I wanted to read from Joel, who says, "If we're going to move forward with gene editing, we need a healthier definition of disability. Many assume disability is negative and humanity would be better off without it. Those of us in the disabled community disagree."
It's people in the disability rights community who have been among the loudest and most vocal voices raising the questions that we're talking about here.
Indeed. And let me bring another caller aboard here. Let's go to you, Craig. Greg, thanks for waiting. You're on.
Hi. Hey, thanks for the program. This is a great and important topic. I am a scientist. I worked on some of the early gene sequencing tools. An issue that hasn't been brought up that is significantly important is that we don't currently understand all of the functionality of genes. We may know some of their properties, but for instance, in sickle cell anemia, there's obviously a negative effect of that gene, but it also had the positive effect of some protection against malaria, as I believe. And that, although that's not sufficient to maybe prevent knocking it out, it's hard to do, if not impossible, to do ethical knockout studies on human beings to figure out what genes might be successfully eliminated without causing harm. So not knowing all of the functionality of each gene, why it was evolutionarily selected to be part of our system, was it from a virus that found it advantageous to put it into us, or did we adapt something to have a good function for us? Without that knowledge, it's very risky to start removing gene variants from the body.
Yeah, thank you for those comments. And let me go to you, Alex Marson.
I echo the point. I think humility in the face of what we don't know is critical here. And I think I've told you where I draw the line on these things, but I also think beyond that, there's an important risk-benefit analysis that has to be done in any clinical trial. And even for those who argue vociferously that there should be gene editing to treat severe genetic mutations that would affect quality of life, length of life, I think that in this case, the bar was clearly not passed. The risk of HIV could have been mitigated in a number of other ways. And this was something that was done, I think, to really highlight the power of gene editing rather than with the best interests of these children in mind.
We've been talking about Brave New World a lot. Let me go back to you on this, Alex Marson. Here's William, who says, does Cas9 editing enable militaries to be able to have genetically engineered super soldiers like those we see in video games and movies?
I think that a critical point about gene editing is the flexibility and power of this technology. As we heard earlier in the program from Dr. Ernov, the reason that this has captured the imagination of scientists is that it is extremely easy to direct Cas9 to edit essentially any site in the human genome. And we're getting better and better at the technical aspects of changing specific sequences. That said, there is still an enormous amount unknown about the consequences of any sequence we introduce. And we're not yet at the point where we can actually have a targeted understanding of designing humans the way we want. So I think there's two levels of fear. I think that we will make mistakes if we start going in and trying to design humans with any goal in mind of the type of human we want to produce. And second of all, even if we could succeed, I think that the risk there is even bigger as sequencing technology and knowledge of the genome improves, there is a serious risk that it will become plausible for us to design humans with some features in mind. And if we can do so, I think that that we will have fundamentally changed what it means to be human.
And we've brought up another caller here. We'll get as many of you on as we can in the time remaining. Yvette in Palo Alto, join us. You're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
We've talked a lot about physical illnesses, and I'm hesitating because of the feedback I'm getting.
Yeah, you should turn down your radio. Turn off your radio, actually, Yvette. Otherwise, it'll go into your consciousness and interfere with your remarks. But just talk to us. Tell us what's on your mind.
Okay. Well, recently there's been some research on the genetic determination of some psychiatric disorders, particularly like borderline personality disorder and some others, and the possibility of testing for that, not while the person's in utero, but maybe after they've had an incident and been in the hospital or...
Okay, it's a big, significant question, and I want to get right to it here, because Dr. Ernov is nodding his head. And, when we talk about mental illness, and particularly still a lot to learn about genetics and schizophrenia and things of that sort, but in the womb or in utero, as she's bringing up, if we could discover the possibilities with CRISPR?
Thank you for bringing this up.
She actually is asking about adults, though, too.
Oh, yeah. I think something that drives me and my fellow gene editors, such as Alex Marson, is a passionate desire to combine two remarkable advances of the past 30 years, which is that we can read human DNA and, as you allude to, discover genes or variants of genes that make us susceptible to particular kinds of severe disease, and then marry that to the astonishing power of CRISPR to, for the first time, begin to address diseases where we've had essentially nothing clinically for centuries. The big challenge for all of us is how to do this in a way where we convince ourselves we've done no harm. And unequivocally, the way that is done today, and in fact, let me emphasize that, as Alex Marson pointed out, he and many others around the world are doing the clinical trials or preparing for them as we speak, where you take the cell, you genetically, you CRISPR it, and then you put it back in. or you take an organ in a living human being, you gene edit it, and you see whether the disease has gotten better. What do we do about disease that is not simply genetic? You know, callers mentioned cystic fibrosis or sickle cell disease. I don't think there is any fundamental difference from a CRISPR perspective of dealing with a disease that is caused by one gene or dealing with a disease that's caused by seven. The real question is, how do we safely and ethically advance an experimental therapeutic when we discover what those seven genes for borderline personality disorder are? And I assure you that editing an embryo is not step one. Step one is exactly what Alex Marson described to you so carefully a second ago, which is go through a rigorous ethical process of safety and efficacy review before doing the first in human clinical trial on a consenting adult.
We're all in agreement that we're off the path here with this, the path that we should be on. And I want to remind listeners that Chinese scientists first edited genes to a human embryo in a lab back in 2015. It just shows you the speed and the kind of quantum movement that we're on here. Let me get another caller on in the meantime, and that's you, Caitlin. Welcome.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. My question is about something a little different. I think gene editing for diseases, potential diseases, is incredible, and that should be pursued. But when it comes to physical appearances, gene editing on kind of a, I don't know if it's a simpler platform, but I've heard you can edit genes inside of the embryo to determine your baby's eye color, skin complexion, like hair, all that sort of stuff. And then that kind of dives into a dangerous place of what a perfect human is and what we expect. And is that happening?
Well, that's just what we're talking about in terms of concerns here at Designer Babies again. Marcy Darnofsky?
Well, I'm not aware of anyone that's doing that kind of work on gene editing, and I hope scientists are not doing that.
You don't know. Who would have expected this,
right? And we know that there is a fertility doctor in Los Angeles who a couple years ago offered a program to use the embryo screening technique, which I think should be used in certain conditions, but he was advertising it for hair color, eye color, and skin color. So could he do it? Who knows? But does the marketing of that have a really dangerous social effect? Yes, I think it does.
All right. And let me go to the next caller, and that's Claudia joining us. Claudia, welcome. You're on the air. Good morning.
Hi. Thank you so much. I'm a mother of a child with a rare genetic disorder. And I'm, you know, I've been so excited by the CRISPR technology, but I'm nervous now that these latest events are going to somehow, I hope it does not affect the research with CRISPR and the technology for children like mine.
I think that's really an important point that you bring up. And I think what we need to do is to make it very clear that there are responsible ways to make these scientific advances and that there are irresponsible and dangerous applications of them. And we have so much problem in our society with understanding what science is and what should be supported, and sometimes abuses of science that we need to draw lines against. And I think, you know, in a country where there are people who are so opposed to vaccinating their children, to introduce these kinds of concerns without a clear commitment on the part of scientific leadership to do it the right way, I think we're just going to dig ourselves deeper into the problems that we have on the score of public trust.
You mentioned vaccination. It also makes me think of the fact there are some people, you speak about words like genetic modification, and they get very nervous and upset and don't like to hear anything along those lines coming into the fore. Alex Marson, I'll go back to you on this.
There's so many things that I'm trying to decide which thread to pick up here. I think that the issue of, I guess to respond directly to the caller, it's calls like this that are at the core of my motivation, and I think at the motivation for many of us who are engaged in these efforts, being responsive to the needs of parents who have children with genetic diseases. And I think that we want to think carefully about the ethics, but also respond to pressing medical needs. And in some cases, that means pre-implantation genetics and screening. And in others, it's thinking about how can we design more effective treatments for these children who are born. That could be drugs, or it could be targeted gene and cell therapy.
Another quick question from a listener about Hezhong Wei and where maybe this is all going to go. Barbara says, Ginny says, what's going to happen to him? What's the appropriate consequence so that others do not go rogue? Is this currently considered as criminal? There's certainly been talk along those lines. Marcy?
Well, he is being investigated, apparently, by his university. The hospital where he did the work is disavowing him. I think it will bear really careful looking what the Chinese authorities do. But I also think we have to look at what the organizers of the Gene Editing Summit did. And I'm pretty shocked that they gave him not one but two speaking slots at this high-profile summit.
And the one that's going on now in Hong Kong.
That's going on now in Hong Kong. And that the statement that the organizers of this Gene Editing Summit in Hong Kong issues was tepid at best about this.
We're going to have to leave it there. Thank you all for being with us. It's been a most enlightening hour, and I appreciate you all being here. Fyodor Urnov, Marcy Darnovsky, Alex Marson, and another hour of Forum is up ahead, so stay tuned for that. And thank you for being a part of this hour and for all of us here at KQED. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation, and by Jan Schremm and Maria Minetti Schremm, founders of the Minetti Schremm Museum of Art at UC Davis, which preserves the legacy of renowned artists such as Wayne Thiebaud for future innovators by dedicating a third of its space to arts education.